today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
You know, if you're pulling a player off the court for 5 minutes to give them a breather before they go back on, I think what they do in those 5 minutes determines their play when they get back on the court afterward.
So today we are joined by Fess Aswat. Fess teaches yoga and meditation in the Boston area. He's been teaching for over 20 years and has worked with several teams, organizations, and individuals in the Northeast. And we really have a great conversation about the benefits of yoga and mindfulness practice for athletes. And he gives us some really good takeaways for coaches who are interested in implementing those things with their teams, and even for athletes who may be listening that are interested in learning more. You know, certainly has some natural fits when working with athletes, as he was an athlete himself, grew up playing hockey, and still plays to this day. And also talks a lot about his experience as an accomplished musician, and the parallels between being on stage, performing with athletes being on the court. So again, great conversation. We hope you enjoy. Please write us a review, subscribe to the podcast. And if you're interested in learning more about Fess or having him come speak or work with your team, you can visit his website at fezaswat.com, F-E-Z-A-S-W-A-T.com. And please follow along with what we are doing at risingcoaches.com. Fess, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing good.
So I'm excited to have you on the podcast today, and I appreciate you taking the time. I think everybody knows the phrase, you know, like sports is, you know, 10% physical, 90% mental. But I think if you believe that, which I think a lot of people do, I don't know that the, you know, practice reflects that ratio. And I'm not sure how much people really actually work on the mental side of sports and performance with their teams. So I'm excited to have you on today because you are an expert and have practiced yoga and mindfulness and meditation for over 20 years. So you certainly have some expertise in both of those areas, and excited to like jump into it with you today. So thanks again for being here.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. I mean, I've been looking forward to this for a while, so here we are.
So yeah, so we've known each other our whole lives, or my whole life. I've known you.
Your whole life. I had a hot minute without you there.
Right, but so let's for the listeners give them a little bit of background on you. How did you come to the practice of yoga, and you know, how long have you been doing this?
Yoga specifically, or both yoga and meditation? Because they interweave with one another.
Yeah, let's do both.
So it started off with meditation practice, which I feel very fortunate that was the beginning point. And, you know, I was, let's see, near 20 years old, maybe just about 20 years old. And, you know, quite frankly, I think the stressors that exist when I don't know that we want to call them kids, but you know, that time range from when you leave your home after high school, you know, when I left my home up until 22, there's just so much that you're figuring out. And there's so many pressures from not only the culture, but from your family and the expectations of the culture and your community. And I found that feeling tugged in so many different directions of what I thought I should be doing was preventing me from living, I think, what in a way that was natural for who I was. And I found that I needed something to release the grip of all of the stressors. I needed something so that all the different influences that were not the influence of, you know, my own inner intelligence, you know, the intelligence of my mind or the intelligence of my spirit, if you wanted to call it. I wanted to hear what it was saying without it feeling influenced by those externalities. And I went to meditation practice because you know, it was still weird at the time. This was like the late 90s, you know, it wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. You couldn't stand in line at a grocery store and look at a magazine that was entitled Mindfulness. You know, in fact, mindfulness wasn't even the phrase at the time. It was just meditation practice. And I went to it because I thought if I could quiet a lot of the noise of the external stressors, that I'd be able to hear the intelligence of what it was that I needed to follow. And in so doing, what it did was it gave me a lot of emotional relief, just a ton of emotional relief. I started to feel okay, you know, in a way that I'd always wanted to experience. And that was around 20. So that was about 2 years before I started practicing yoga.
So much of what you've said already, like, resonates with me in terms of athletics.
Right.
Because, you know, I coached college basketball for 17 years, but whether you coach college, high school, professional, you know, your athletes have so much going on. I mean, put their lives aside and just think about them as just athletes, which is unfair to do because they do have the same stressors that you and I and everybody wakes up with every day, whether it's their parents or friends, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever. And then they get, you know, the sport that they love and have played their whole lives. Now they're on a team where there's, you know, a new system, something that's foreign to them. They're being asked to mold what they do into a greater team concept. And there's so much thought that's going through their mind. And to, you know, I would think to be able to quiet all that noise and just be connected to who you are is a really pretty powerful thing.
Well, and the other thing that's really challenging about that age range, and I can relate to it because I was constantly playing, you know, I was playing gigs with a lot of different bands at the time, and I was really trying to forge ahead as a musician in my community. And so what you have, the parallel that has with the younger athletes is that their life as athletes is a full life unto itself, right? Like, if all they did was, the only responsibility that they had was to their athleticism, that's a full-time schedule. And on top of that, they had to go through going through college. And I think the combination, you know, and kids who go through college, like, that's a full-time schedule as well. So they're almost like having to live two lives at the same time while having to navigate everything else, I think must be a really, really challenging way. I mean, I know they're used to it. They probably came up in high school doing the same thing. But my guess is the schedule for some of these younger athletes is like from the minute they wake up until the minute they go to sleep every single day, which even in adult life is, you know, while that is the case for us as we have families, but I know that prior to having a kid, there was still more space. So I don't know how much space they actually have throughout a day because they're so committed to, like, all the things they have to tend to.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think the space that people have, you know, in that world is extremely limited. So, you know, I guess this is a way, if you don't have physical space, maybe you can find some space in your mind with some practice.
That's really what it's about. The truth is, I think our best performances, and in this case specifically, athletic performances, comes from a spacious and a silent place. And I mean that predominantly mentally. I mean, you're talking about 10%. Well, what was it, 10%?
Well, I made those numbers up. What is it? I think it's 90% mental, 10% physical, but I don't.
Yeah.
I could have just pulled that
right
out of my.
But the truth is, if you take that mental aspect, and, you know, when we're okay, when we're clear, when things are fine, like, our game can come straight from that. And when that is cluttered, when it's thicker weather in that mental space, I think it must be harder to access it. And I mean, sometimes the sport can feel like the release. The sport itself can feel like, okay, that's where I can let everything go. But I imagine that there are times when the challenges actually move in, and when you're not playing your best game, that itself becomes a challenge. So I think learning the skill set of how to develop a clarity of mind, you know, I can't see what it doesn't benefit. You know, there's a there's a person named Dan Harris, who's been a strong proponent of mindfulness in our modern era. He did the 10% Happier podcast, and he was saying that he thinks in the long run that learning to figure out how to quiet the mind, how to soften some of the agitators that exist mentally in meditation practice is going to be as much of, you know, I don't want to, you know, the phrase might not be perfect, but it's going to be as much of a no-brainer in the long run as, you know, us knowing if you run, you get in shape. You know, 20 minutes a day on a treadmill has benefits for cardiovascular health. And it's going to be the same thing, that if people say, okay, if you can just quiet yourself and sit in meditation for 20 minutes a day, the effects that it's going to have is no longer something that they're going to need science to prove that that's the case. You know, and we're in the phase right now, it's like there's a lot of a sale going on, like it does work, it does work, it does work. Once you start practicing, it's like, oh yeah, like you don't really need a lot of the science to convince you that that's the case, because you have a week where you meditate and by the end of the week you're doing okay. If you have a week where you don't meditate, by the end of that week, it's like you feel like the different things in your life are pulling you in different directions again. And so just, you know, it just takes a little bit of experience and you say, ah, this is what all that, you know, all those articles that are, you know, all over the place at this point are pointing towards. But I don't know if you want me to get back to how I got into yoga.
Yeah, sure, please.
I was practicing the meditation and I was really, you know, getting some legs with it. And I was finding that everything was improving in terms of just the way I was relating to people. You know, I was exercising fairly regularly. The way it was affecting my physical health was actually improved as well, because I found that the combination of physical exercise and the meditation practice were just a strong combo. And then at the end of that year, when I first started, my best friend died in a car accident. His brother passed away. And I found that the meditation practice seemed like it just wasn't enough, and I needed something to bolster me out of it. And I had been, you know, playing music probably 5 or 6 hours a day at that time, and my hands just stopped working. They called it repetitive stress injury, and I went to 5 months of physical therapy here in Boston. And 5 months of physical therapy, my hands just still had the exact same amount of pain that I had started out with. Like nothing had improved. I remember they put electrodes on my arms, they put ice on my arms. They were constantly trying to figure out all these different massage techniques, but they were working basically from my elbow to my fingertips to deal with my wrist. And then at the time, I was working at the space where there were a bunch of dancers, and they had convinced me to try yoga. And you know, and this is 1999. And yoga at the time was just this really weird thing. You couldn't find a yoga mat anywhere, let alone yoga props anywhere. There were two yoga studios in town that I only found out about years later. There were like no yoga studios. There were very few resources. And so finally, like one of those dancers convinced me to go to this yoga class. And I remember going, and I remember thinking I had no idea what I was doing. But I walked out of that class and my hands were better for about 2 or 3 days after, you know, 5 months of physical therapy not working. And I was like, okay, well, something's going on here. So I went back to class because it was helping me with my practice. And after 3 yoga classes, I never had to go back to physical therapy. I never had that repetitive stress injury pain ever again. So the other thing that I found out was the combination of the yoga and the meditation gave me a level of clarity that was unimaginable for me up until that point. And I, you know, the amount of frustration that I had after Zaki died in the car accident was really, really high, and the grief was really, really high. But I think that the way that I was able to recover from it was wholly due to the efficacy of these two practices, of meditation practice and yoga practice together. And then the yoga practice continued until, you know, people started naturally asking me to teach them and show them. You know, at that time it wasn't, it was basically like the people that were advancing in classes were the ones that were becoming the teachers. And we, you know, so I was teaching a fair amount of folks at the time, but I really wanted to understand why did it work as a practice. And it took me years to find a teacher who was able to explain to me what it was about yoga that was actually healing. And unfortunately, before I met him, I had gone through a fair amount of yoga where I had teachers that couldn't explain it. And those were the teachers who I'd practice with and I'd get some kind of injury. So it took me years to find a teacher who explained, this is why this works for health benefits. And this is how you can actually focus in on the health benefits a little bit more, and then I don't think the knowledge is really readily out there in the yoga world right now. It is to a certain degree. It just depends on who's practicing and how they're learning.
Is that something, you know, you mentioned when you were going to physical therapy for your wrist that they were working from your elbow down to your fingertips.
Right.
What was the approach in yoga? I mean, was it a more full body approach to heal your wrist, or, you know, does that kind of translate a little bit about why, you know, what you were talking about, your quest to find out why yoga works as a practice?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a far more holistic approach to what's occurring. I think physical therapy at this point, that's not going to be the case. I mean, this was definitely physical therapy at that time. And beyond that, it was the physical therapy at that time that my insurance could work with. And I think physical therapy at this point has really, like most modalities towards healing that, you know, that are clinical by nature, like the knowledge that we've gotten over the past 20 years has improved. So all of these fields are improving. But at that time, you know, my specific experience, they weren't working with it in a holistic manner. And I think what was occurring in yoga was essentially what was happening with my wrist, like the origins of the discomfort was, I think, far more related to my spine and the fact that I had, you know, the upper half of the spine and how it relates to the shoulder and then how it relates to gradually down to the fingertips. And I think, you know, I had a 15-pound weight slung over my shoulder with that bass that I played. You know, I had a German bass of Warwick. It was great. It sounded amazing. But it was just very taxing on my hands. And the way that I was playing at the same time, I think I was playing with a fair amount of tension. And it took me a long time to figure out how to undo the tension. So one of the other benefits that I had from the yoga was that I found that while I was playing in the middle of performance situations, I almost more instinctively was in tune with how my body was operating and when I was playing with more tension than I actually needed. And it wasn't even cognitive. It wasn't even like necessarily a choice that I would say mentally I had to let go. It was just the ability to play in a more fluid manner was just getting much easier for me with the way the yoga practice was working for me.
And so is that kind of how yoga and meditation kind of interweave in that, you know, yoga is making you more connected with your body? And be more aware of your own body and, you know, the ability to concentrate and look inward is something that the meditation helps you become skilled at.
Yeah, well, you know, so one of the common things in yoga is they say that yoga is a practice to prepare you for a meditation practice. But in my view, it's both yoga is something that, for me, it was a response to meditation practice. That once I knew how to meditate, I actually knew how to meditate in the context of the yoga posture. And one thing that's really tricky is, especially if somebody really understands how to meditate, learning how to meditate it's like you learn the skill of how to meditate just within the meditation itself. But then what yoga would help me with is how you can transition that meditative frame of mind into something else. So you learn how to do it in an embodied way. You know, you find yourself in a posture where there's a lot of, you know, it's a little tighter. It's a little bit more uncomfortable. If you take any athlete, if you put them on in any situation where it's a little uncomfortable, you know, where they're a little bit behind and maybe, you know, one of your stronger players is not fully on their game, you have to figure out how to adjust. You have to figure out how to come out of it. And so what happens is if you can figure that out mentally in meditation practice, what happens is the yoga practice becomes the palette to figure out how to do it physically, how to do it in a very physical situation. So all of a sudden you have, you know, in a meditation practice, you've learned to do it just with your mind. And then in the yoga practice, you're figuring out, okay, now you have the mind and you have the body interplaying with something actually very active. And how do you work with the two together there? And I think if you go from that then into another situation, your ability to go from a mind state that you want into a mind state that exists in a body that you're wanting to work with, and then into an activity, it starts to all flow more instinctive. I know you used the phrase yesterday when we were talking about, was it don't think, just react?
Right.
Right, that was the phrase. And, you know, it's a different, the word reaction is a very loaded question, a loaded word in meditation practice. But I would use the word instinct, that the instinct is just coming straight from the most intelligent part of your own aptitude. It's able to flow through right into the skill set that you're doing, I think, a little bit better. You know, when I've got the two in balance, when I've got a meditation practice and the yoga practice in balance, that's when I'm better at pretty much everything that I'm doing.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. What difference in your performance? You know, you mentioned you're a musician. So, mm-hmm. and then in addition to that, we haven't talked about this, but you grew up playing hockey and still play mm-hmm. hockey to this day. Mm-hmm. So what difference in your performance, if any, did you notice once you became very skilled in both yoga and meditation?
The biggest thing that I'm noticing is I catch when I've got a frame of mind that is not going to help me in those situations. You know, I can be either mid-hockey game or even mid-performance on stage, and the instant my mind turns into a direction that's going to make me start trying to force situations to happen, I can catch it a little bit quicker. And the instant I catch it, I find spaces where I might be able to pop. You know, hockey is really easy because you're going to be, you know, on the shift, and then you're going to be on the bench for, you know, until your next shift. And so it's a very convenient time for you to find some meditation practice. With music, it's a little trickier because you have to keep up with the tempo of the song. But there's still, like, really quick ways that you can get yourself out of that negative mind frame. If you practice enough of these techniques, you start to naturally look for, okay, which technique is going to work for me such that I can clear the mind of the storm that's coming in so I can just get back to the task at hand. And the longer, I mean, this comes with maturity as well, but, you know, for me, I don't think that I would be able to access that frame of mind without the meditation practice being such a fulcrum of how I live. So that's it. I can just catch the negativity a lot quicker and then sort of resolve it and get back to the thing that I'm good at.
You mentioned yesterday when we were talking that one of your techniques is audible. Like you listen for certain things to snap you out of that mind frame. Mm-hmm. Can you share? Can mm-hmm. you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I remember having, should I tell you about that game that I was talking about before?
Yeah, tell me about the hockey experience.
Yeah, so I had like a few weeks in a row where I was playing really well, and then one time I was at a game, and I was just cranky. I was in a bad mood when I got there. I got on the ice, and generally, you know, being in a game setting will snap me out of it because there's a joyfulness to it, but it wasn't clicking, and I was just kind of off, a little bit cranky. And I had this thought that I thought, I'm in a bad mood and I need a win to fix this. I need to score to fix this. And that thought can sometimes propel you into playing really well, but sometimes it can propel you into just thinking you egoically have to forego all of the intelligence just to force a goal to happen. And I think, you know, especially in team sports, as soon as somebody thinks they're in charge of the whole thing, then the team dynamic can get really rattled. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and I would say, like, it's very rare for someone to have that frame of mind and actually perform at a higher level. There's some people that can do that, but it's like most people, it completely throws them off their game.
I mean, I think the players that can do that, in some ways, it's got to be you have to know when to let them go with it, because they can pull a whole team in that direction. But sometimes if it's not working, then it's almost like they're tripping over themselves over and over again, you know? And so
this is why,
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Like, this is going to take us off topic a little bit, but we both love tennis, and I love tennis so much because it's an individual sport and you get to like witness people going through these internal battles. And Djokovic,
so psychological. Yeah.
Yeah, and Djokovic is nuts. Like, he's one of these guys that, like, you see the way he like behaves in between points and you think to yourself, like, this guy is about to just get killed. But he is one of those rare guys that can, like, that actually propels his performance.
I mean, I think Jordan was like that too. Like, you know, he'd go forward and you'd be like, is like everything that I learned about team sports, the sheer amount of talent that he had could pull you through it. But I remember, you know, I didn't have in any sport, I didn't have that level of talent at all. Like many
people. Yeah, we're talking about the best evers in their sports. So anyways, right. Get back to your story. I'm sorry.
But that's true. Like, shy of that, if somebody is thinking, you know, they're gonna muscle through it and force the game, then that's when turnovers happen. That's when, you know, people start fouling when they don't really need to. So I was on the ice and I had that mentality, thinking, okay, I need to force some kind of win. I need to force something to make me feel better. And at the instant I had that thought, I thought, okay, that's a big red flag for me. You know, something that I say is that we tend to confuse the red flags for the checkered ones, that you think you're going to come to a conclusion, you know, and you're thinking, okay, I'm going to force this. And it's like, it's the end of the story and I'm going to keep going, but it's actually a big red flag saying, watch out. And I got on the bench, and as soon as I caught, okay, I'm going into, you know, this ego-based mind, I need to get out of it. What I did was I would start listening to all the sounds I could hear, and especially sounds as far away as possible, and think, was there one sound I could find that could settle me down just a little bit? And there was a sound of a really, really loud fan in the rink. And I would just focus on that fan. The thing that I think when I practice in this way is the sound of that fan is further away than my negative thought. And so if I can focus in on the sound of that fan just a little bit more, it will give me a little bit of spaciousness to see if that negative thought can just kind of float away, so that a more positive frame of mind can come into space. And I kept doing that technique plus a few other ones that would take me a lot longer to explain. But by the time I jumped back on the ice, I was back on the ice for the love of the game, for the love of the sport, for the connectivity that I had to the team. And I was just playing very beautifully. I couldn't care if I scored a goal or didn't. And what wound up happening was I wound up, you know, having a hat trick that day. I scored 3 goals that day. I had 2 assists. It was one of the best games I'd ever played. But the thing was, I was playing not from the need, the desperate need to make it happen. I was playing from the history of my love of the sport. I was playing from the history of training. I was playing from the connectivity that I had to the teammates. And that was what brought out my game. And so I had to like clear that storm that was brewing. It's like you can catch the cyclone right when it's happening, so you can undo it a little bit quicker, you know?
Yeah, that's such a great illustration of what you're talking about and the importance of this practice. Because you see it all the time. I think this is why you see like the progression of athletes in college, where like their freshman year, maybe they show like spurts of being good, and then their sophomore year, you know, they're a little bit, you know, a little bit better, and maybe like a little less inconsistent in their junior year. And then there's by their senior year, you know, maybe now they're comfortable enough where, you know, that they're not out there getting caught up in the moment, getting caught up in, well, my coach just yelled at me. Maybe he didn't even want me to shoot. I should just be out here, you know, and you're second guessing, you know, sometimes with younger athletes, you can almost see them second guessing themselves out there. And that's when you got to pull them off the court or the ice or whatever. But
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So when you catch the younger players in that mind state, right, and it's mid game, how do you work with it?
You know, I think it's so hard in the middle of a game when there's emotions are so heightened to really do much like mental work with somebody. You can pull them out of the game. You can try to be really calm with them and talk to them and downplay like the situation. Hey, you're good. Just stay with us. Stay positive. You know, I think it comes down to, like, you got to know your individual athletes and have great relationships for them, and more importantly, have a great feel for, like, their triggers and what, you know, some people in that situation might need to get yelled at just for their own purpose because it might snap them out of something. Some people may need, like, a gentle hand and an arm around their shoulder, you know, where other people, that might further propel them down the spiral. Other guys just, like, need to be left alone and get out of it for themselves. So I don't know that there's a perfect answer other than, like, yeah, but everybody's different.
The players who last the 4 years on the team, right, you might see that settle over the course of the 4 years while the players are there.
Yeah, definitely. It always settles to some extent, and for some it completely goes away. Some it's still going to be around 4 years later, but not as bad. You know, I think you figure out how to, like, self-check a little bit. And, you know, if you actually worked at it, a mindfulness practice, you know, or yoga to get you in tune with yourself, like, I think you could probably speed that process up a lot.
Well, that's the thing. And so I think, you know, and I'm not going to say that it's a practice that works for 100% of people. I think some people come to this practice with a little bit too much doubt. And, you know, it just really doesn't sit well with them. But for the people who this works for, that progression of whatever maturity you see that takes place in a person's mind or a person's spirit from their freshman year all the way to their senior year, 4 years of play, it's like this can be the thing, I think, that unlocks their ability to work with themselves as things are unfolding, because you put them in more situations, you know. And the other thing that happens is if you have some of the older players that are learning how to work with their mind states as they come up, they can wind up being, you know, they wind up being the players that might be able to help a younger player out, because that younger player is, you know, has not been in quite as many situations. And they're probably coming up to a level of play that is the highest level of play they've seen just thus so far. Right. So they're, you know, the habit for them to maybe, I don't know. I mean, I guess they would say you would want the younger player to find the maturity of the senior players a little bit faster, to have it be something that they respect and move into. And I think for the younger people who take to this kind of a practice, it can be, you know, for me, especially at that age, it was a make it or break it between a good week or a bad week. And if you give an entire skill set for them to figure out, well, this is how I can actually do something to help the mind along, you know, then I think it can be, you know, invaluable. And my guess is all of these players, to some degree, before game situations, are doing something to clear their mind, right? There's a pre-game ritual for everybody.
Right. Each individual has their own thing, and then each team has their own warm-ups that kind of should put you in that mindset. However, you know, you're talking about 18 to 20, you know, at the college level, 18 to 22-year-olds who are, their minds are all over the place. You know, mm-hmm. I'm 35, my mind's all over the place. But at that age, mm-hmm. I mean, you're still not fully, a lot of people aren't still fully aware of who they are. And, you know, you may be worried, scanning the crowd, looking to see who's there, still trying to get, you know, like, still worrying about girls or boys or what, you know, whatever. There's so much distraction involved.
You know, and with the smartphone world that we live in right now, it's in some ways noisier than it's ever been.
You know, yeah, no question.
My curiosity is, like, are there players at this age that are on the phone right up until game time?
Fess, at halftime. You see people checking their phones.
Wow.
I mean, it's wild. I mean, teams, you know, every team has a team rule probably where, like, no phones in the locker room, you know, and it should be a given, like, don't check your phone during the game. But, like, you're naive to think that it's not happening. I've even seen, like, guys who are injured and not playing, you know, and they're in street clothes on the bench. Yeah. They have their phones on them, and when guys get subbed out, you know, they'll be looking over their friend's shoulder, like, looking at their phone at something during the game. It's wild. It's wild, man.
So do you see it affecting their game?
Or
is it like nothing?
Again, I think everyone's different. You know, like, yeah. I can't sit here and be like the old man at the end of the block saying, like, these damn kids. Right. You know, like, it's just like a way of life now, society. And
yeah.
I mean, look, my mom's 70, and she's glued to her phone more than anybody on the face of the earth. Like, it's all of us.
It's like that post-meal time at Thanksgiving where it's everyone's phone time on the couch. Like, everyone's got it. You know, it's built into our culture. And, you know, it can be a little bit of a checkout that I think can help people, but I think there's just as much drama in that device as there is relief in that device. And if somebody lands in the territory of the drama when they're trying to focus on another skill, it can be a really tricky thing. I mean, you know, I have that just in marriage. Like, if I'm having half of my head is in a conversation that's happened on my device, you know, either through text, just through social media or something like that, my wife is just telling me these are the things we have to do in the house. I could not pay attention for longer than is healthy for a relationship.
Right. So I think, like, the value in being able to shut, you know, quiet your mind, be in the moment, and rely on your instincts and your years of knowledge, you know, is really evident. Like, how long do you have to dedicate? Because this is the other thing. We touched on it. You know, like, these athletes' schedules are jam-packed. I mean, you're waking up. You probably got mandatory breakfast for your athletes in there in classes. As soon as they get out of class, you know, they're going to the weight room. Then they got to go get lunch. Then they got to do some physical therapy. Then they're there for practice. And they get out of practice, they're going to study hall. You know, like, so there's already so much jam-packed into – you know, their schedules. How much time do you really need to dedicate a day to a meditation practice or a mindfulness or a yoga or all of the above to really see some benefits?
You know, I think different teachers are going to say different things. And I think a lot of what we're trying to figure out as teachers in the modern era is how do we actually practice as the culture that we are, you know. I always think that this culture that we live in is unprecedented. This American culture is more pluralistic and more technologically advanced, arguably, than any other culture that's ever existed, maybe in the face of humanity. And we're busy. And, you know, another thing that's often said is we can jump from being human beings into human doings very, very quickly. We're just constantly doing things, and we have to figure out how to get some downtime from that. But it is important to figure out, you know, what I call it. I call it practice in the pockets, that you find the little pockets. And I think that's the beginning point. I remember working with a mom who she had two young children, and she was going through a divorce, and her father, who she was caretaking for, was in the middle of cancer treatment. And she said, I really just don't know how to make time for this. And so we used to work on a 5-breath meditation, and she used to find the pockets. And sometimes the pocket was when she'd turn off the car before she'd go into another place. And she would sit in her car and just do a 5-breath meditation. And that gradually built to a 5-minute meditation. So I think initially when people are doing the practice, they have to find the little pockets. You know, one of the most advanced teachers in the United States right now, her name is Pema Chodron, and she says, you know, when you find that you're hooked into a state of mind that can make you react in a way that you would potentially not want to react, she said, before you do that thing, can you just insert 3 breaths? You know, suggestion that another mindfulness teacher, a meditation teacher, says that, you know, if you're going to write that email that's going to, you know, or you're really giving it to somebody, that can you delete the names from the sender? So it's like, and then so you write the email first, and then you have to reinsert the person's email to make sure you want to send it. The first thing you do is you just find the spaces, even if it's not much, you know. I think people who have deep religious practices, they figure out, you know, it's a beautiful thing. Before a meal, they figure out how to insert a prayer. And that's inserting just a little bit of time right there. You know, it can be that you figure out just before you head onto the court. You close your eyes, you take 1 minute. And I do think these little shifts can accumulate to make you want to do the practice a little bit more because you start to see the benefits. But I think there's always benefit in pausing, you know? And you don't necessarily need to start with a lot to see the benefit of pausing, to see the benefit of saying, let me just take a second here. And then that is, you know, I'm working with one of the New England crew teams right now, the rowing teams. And that's just kind of where we're starting. It's just, okay, well, find out, well, how do you build it in naturally at this point? And then let's accumulate a little bit. Let's accumulate a little bit. And after a while, when it accumulates, it's like, it becomes really obvious. Like, okay, and it makes sense for me to do this for a longer period of time because it's actually beneficial.
I want to get back to the athletes you're working with now in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Before we get there, I want to finish this thought. Yoga, I assume, is a little bit different. Like, that's something maybe, or maybe it's not, but can you fit yoga into small pockets like that, or is that something you need to dedicate, you know, 30 minutes here or 45 minutes there to see benefits in that practice?
I mean, I think with yoga practice, there's a way, you know, like when I first started taking yoga, it was like every class was 90 minutes long. Now it's like most classes are about an hour, and they still feel short for me. But I do think, you know, for people who have other skill sets, there is a way to practice in 20-minute increments. You know, like my guess is like even before you're training, I mean, there's probably, you know, before they're at the gym, isn't there 20 minutes of stretching that winds up happening at any point in time, or is it just 5 to 10 usually?
Yeah, every team's different. 10 minutes probably is probably average of a 10-minute warm-up. And it's usually guided by, you know, a strength and conditioning coach.
Right. And the truth is, I mean, I think, you know, the 10 minutes up top and maybe 10 minutes at the end, as so long as the principles are there, you can communicate the principles of yoga in that time. It's helpful to have longer stretches where you practice and you know what you're doing. And then after you have some clue what you're doing, then you can start to do it in smaller pockets. You can start to say, well, let me just take 5 minutes to do this basic principle. You know, one of the basic principles that, you know, my teacher, who has done a fair amount of work with gymnasts, and, you know, and there's a lot of overlap between yoga and gymnastics as well, but, you know, yoga is not really, it's not performance-based, and that can be a confusion about it. But, you know, one of the basic principles that he suggests is like when working with the spinal joints to start with, you know, seeing the best you can to create space between the joint and then moving into what's referred to as extension with the spine, then into flexion with the spine, and then turning or twisting and then side bending it after that. And oftentimes what I'll see people doing is they'll start at the end point and be on the verge of, you know, a habit that could in the long run form tearing. So oftentimes what I'm doing, you know, is just inserting the principles. And once they get the principles, you can practice in shorter spans of time that in ways that are still beneficial, you know. But it does take a little bit more training. I'm not going to lie about that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the benefits of yoga in terms of flexibility and injury prevention are pretty like widely accepted all across athletics. I think the mindfulness practice and meditation practice is a little bit further behind, and there still might be a little resistance to that. But
really,
I think so. It's just, you know, you say meditation, it still has that vibe of being, you know, a little weird. But yoga, you can go to the rec center, you know, at every college campus, and there will be a yoga class offered everywhere, guaranteed, every single day.
Right. Well, I mean, the one reason why that's surprising is we've had a whole conversation with a basketball person and a meditation person, and we haven't mentioned Phil Jackson once. So here we are. We're at that point
right
now. But, you know, Phil Jackson said when he was working, I think it was when he was working with the Lakers, but he was saying that he tried so many different things to help the guys out. I think that the stories of him dimming the lights and having them play with the gym a little lighter. You do Tai Chi, you do yoga with them. And he said the one thing that they actually all settled on was meditation practice. And the reason why was because it wasn't, it was subtractive. It wasn't adding anything new. It was actually removing things. It was a point of where you were going to turn things down rather than add an extra activity on top of everything else. You know, and I think that was, there's no injury that can occur from meditation practice. No one's gonna hurt themselves meditating. So it's not at a risk of affecting someone's game in an adverse way at all. You know,
that's a great point.
But yeah, so it is kind of funny to me that I think, like, in terms of basketball, like, you know, there's another meditation teacher in basketball named George Mumford. Have you heard of him?
I haven't.
George Mumford's big with the NBA, but it's been in the basketball world for a lot longer, meditation and mindfulness practice. So, you know, I do think nationwide that you are starting to see mindfulness as this trend that's coming up, but that hasn't been the case in basketball. Actually, it's been the opposite in basketball. But it is true. At this point, you know, like, you know, you can get yoga pretty much anywhere at this point. You know, there's yoga rooms at airports, at the San Francisco International Airport. When you walk through ticketing, the first thing you see is the yoga room.
I noticed that.
Food court, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going through, I think, the Atlanta airport and saw behind the escalator, instead of having, like, just some wasted space, they had a yoga studio.
Yeah, the main room.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Yeah, I don't know why that is, Fess. I wonder if it's just because, like, you know, yoga, when you talk about benefits of yoga, you're talking about physical benefits. And when you're talking about meditation practice or mindfulness, you know, I guess for a lot of people, they still don't see the connection to how that helps performance, which I agree is probably, like, really short-sighted or narrow-minded. But, you know, or maybe they just feel like there's not enough time in the day, and time would be better well spent in practice or strength training. You know, I don't know. I can't speak for everybody, but it is shocking that it, at the lower levels, like college, high school, that it's not as prevalent. Yeah.
So I used to teach meditation to a staff at a youth at risk program in Boston, in the Boston area, specifically in Chelsea. And one of the staff, he was on the court a lot with these kids. And I told this group, I said, when you really notice that the meditation practice is working, you notice it on the days where you don't meditate. And he said, so he started keeping track of what he was like with the kids on days that he meditated versus what he was like with the kids on the days that he didn't meditate. And he only meditated 10 minutes a day, literally just 10 minutes a day. It wasn't like he was practicing an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening, which was, you know, what I was suggested to do when I first started meditating. And he just did 10 minutes a day. And he said he meditated for an entire week, 10 minutes every morning. And every time he was with the kids, like right as he would find himself about to react with the kid, he would find a different way to work with them. He did find, like, you know, sometimes it's like if a kid's escalating, you can escalate bigger than them to get them to come down, or you can get lower than them. They'll come down to getting a little bit quieter, which is a big thing for parenting as well. And I'm finding with my 8-year-old. And I would always prefer to choose the way that puts you on the same side as the person, so they let you know you're on the same side as them. So he said for a week, he meditated, and he was always choosing the better decision. And he said the next week, the next Monday, he showed up and he forgot that he was doing this, and he didn't meditate. And it was the first time that he snapped on a kid. He said it was the one morning that he didn't meditate. And then he, you know, when I saw him that week, he said, "You're right. The time that I noticed that the meditation was working was on the one day that I didn't do the meditation." So you see that there's something there when you have that reference point, you know?
That's really interesting. What do you think of Headspace or other apps like that where, you know, you do 10 minutes a day on that? Are you familiar with it?
Yeah. Headspace is the app that is most congruent with how I teach. And I find that when I'm working with students who are also doing a Headspace, that the two work well kind of nicely. I find that sometimes the Headspace app is it's very instruction heavy. And so sometimes what I'll encourage people to do is just hit pause when they need a little bit of a breather from the instruction and then unpause when they're ready to go back to it. But it's a wonderful resource to get people started. You know, I also do remind people, you know, people have been meditating without an iPhone app for thousands of years. So in the long run, I think you do want to get to the point in meditation practice where you're able to, you know, be comfortable practicing without it. But in terms of getting started, I think it's a wonderful resource, specifically Headspace. There's also the 10% Happier app, and I'm never sure if they're actually related, but those are the two that seem to work pretty well for people.
And we mentioned it briefly, but now you're working with the crew team. Is it at Northeastern or Boston mm-hmm. College? Which one?
Yeah.
Which one was it?
Northeastern.
Northeastern. Yeah. What are some – do you notice any differences working with athletes – versus working with, you know, like the average person?
Yes, definitively. The ones who are focused are there for it 100%. They're really remarkable. And, you know, they've organized everything around how do they improve their skill set. And they're so receptive that it's really, in some ways, easy to work with them. Another thing that I notice about them is they are above and beyond at responding when you're telling them to do something. And what I mean by that is with this specific team, I'm doing more specific breath work, and I will do a little bit of yoga with them beforehand. And anytime I'm asking them to do something, they respond really, really quickly. They take in instructions almost faster than most yoga classes do. But the hard part for them is when you remove the thing to do, then it's almost like they have to sit with that restlessness. How am I going to just be? How do I just let myself just be? And so as a teacher, I have to go back and forth between giving them almost something like the carrot of here's something to do with your breath. Here's a thing that you can perform. And then what's it like to just let it go? And can you let the mind settle into that unknowing? And I think that's a really big thing in terms of, you know, we were talking about tennis earlier, but like the games that turn around are the ones that are the most amazing to me. The ones where some of the best athletes are behind and they're able to come forward. You know, your New England Patriots that are always able to come forward from behind. It's always like this ability to rest into like the game's not over yet. Let me settle into this and then come back to my game. Let me settle into this and come back to my game. And so that's something that I do notice about the college athletes is that they're good at doing stuff. They have a harder time resting into when there's less going on. And I think what the mind has to do when you're not sure about what you're doing is has as much of a determiner in terms of how you act when it's game time, then you know, it's just as important as what you're doing when you're there. You know, if you're pulling a player off the court for 5 minutes to give them a breather before they go back on, I think what they do in those 5 minutes determines their play when they get back on the court afterwards. You know, which as a hockey player you could see really, really easily.
Sure. Okay, so I want to go back to this. Like we mentioned, mm-hmm. like you can find yoga everywhere. So does going to a local random yoga class at your, you know, student rec center that may have like a student teacher or like a grad student teacher teaching it?
Right.
Does that actually provide a lot of benefit, or like does it need to be somebody at an expert level? Like, can that do more harm than good?
It really depends on the skill level and the amount of experience of the teacher that's teaching. And I think, you know, what they don't tell you is there's as many injuries happening in yoga classes now as there are in any other sport. And one of the main reasons for that is it's very easy to become a yoga teacher. You know, like I'm not saying you could become a yoga teacher by the end of this phone call, but if you could get off this call and you could sign up for some yoga training, and then you could be a teacher, you know, after 200 hours of that training, you still might not have the expertise that it takes to work with various demographics. And so I think the teachers who have been doing this for a really long time and who really understand that if an athlete is coming to them, what's most important isn't that athlete's being able to do yoga well. What's most important is that athlete is able to do yoga to help them enhance their sport. And that means the approach has to be a little bit different. So you're not going to want to contort somebody who's coming as a football player, as a hockey player, as a basketball player. You're not going to want to put them in something that could potentially tear, even a micro tear anywhere in the body. You're not going to want to threaten that. You're not going to want to threaten any type of joint health because you're trying to put them into some kind of posture. And if the focal point of the yoga class is not how do I support these athletes, then there is some possibility that there could be some kind of injury that can encourage us from them going to a yoga class. On the flip side, a lot of the athletes are really smart about knowing how to work with their body, knowing when to push and when not to. So that'll take care of a lot of it. But I do think dependent on sport, it's smarter to have somebody who is organizing a practice for the benefit of that certain body type and that type of athlete, such that it enhances what they need to enhance, but it doesn't put them at risk of injury whatsoever. And the other thing that I think you really have to monitor is they only have so much energy in a day, you know? And so you want to make sure that when they're coming to the yoga, it's not an excess of energy that they're putting into a 60-minute yoga class that's happening at the gym. But it's just the right amount. You know, I used to have a teacher that used to say this is a Goldilocks-based practice. Like, you're just looking for just right all the time. And I think that takes teachers who have been at it for a little bit longer, teachers who've seen different phases and many different body types. When you're working with something like that someone like that who can really cater the practice to the specific style of athlete, then you have a lot more benefit that you can get from the practice. But as you're saying, while there is more access, it can be hard to know, like, how do you get the access to the teachers who have that knowledge, who have been at it for longer, you know?
So if you have the resources to, you know, ask a teacher to cater a program and that teacher is skilled, then by all means, that's a huge benefit. If you're just signing your team up for the 6 a.m. class along with all the other students at the student rec, you better tell your athletes to, like, listen to their body, use their own discretion when it comes to, like, should I be doing this when I know I've got, you know, tendonitis and I know I've got practice later.
Right.
And I had a game last night.
Right. And, you know, something that I'll tell players in that circumstance is pain, no gain. That if they're in there and they're starting to feel like something feels off, to really listen to that, you know.
Which is counterintuitive for most athletes because, like, they're conditioned to push through, you know, push through.
Right, but that push-through mentality in yoga is not necessarily going to help at all.
But yoga for a beginner is like everything's having to push through because that shit is hard.
Well, it depends on what you're doing. It depends on the style.
I'm in a full lather 2 minutes into any yoga class.
Are you really?
Full lather. I mean, dripping sweat. Well, Fess, thanks so much. If people want to find out more, if they want to bring you in to work with their teams, they can do that. And the website is fezaswat.com. That's FEZASWAT.com. Anywhere else, they can contact you directly on that site. Are you on social media or no?
No, just that site.
Okay.
And I don't know if they're going to Rising Coaches at all, but... You can let him know about that.
Yeah. So, of course, we'll have his info on risingcoaches.com. I think we're going to have you scheduled to do some, hopefully, do some webinars with our membership group for our members. And there, you know, we'll have his info if you want to bring him in to do a workshop with your team or your organization. Yeah, Fess, thanks again. This has been great, and really appreciate you taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure.